Here's the word disoriented. You know the word disoriented? Of course you do. It's originally from the French, and it means to turn away from the East. It's an exotic, interesting definition, right? Disoriented. To turn away from the East. And Salman Rushdie further expands on that origin and definition to say that it means failure to find the East. Disoriented is failure to find the East. To be free. What could that mean, to be free? I don't know. I don't really know. Well, I have, like everybody else, I have my ideas about it or my imaginings about what it means to be free. And it's always personal, too. You know, like every love that you have with somebody, every marriage is a separate individual thing that other people can't understand. Every personality is a separate individual thing that nobody else can really understand. So a definition of freedom, I don't know. Everybody's got their own definition of freedom. Certainly I do. Before I begin talking about what I'm going to talk about today, I wanted to mention that I just wrote an essay and posted it to my mailing list. It's not on my website. It may not be on my website. Not really sure. It's my experience upon seeing about a week and a half ago for the first time, seeing a gigantic creche. You know what a creche is? Nativity scene. French word for a nativity scene. You know, in the manger, Joseph, Mary, the baby Jesus, some animals, and that's it, right? But this was on public property, and it was a gigantic not a sweet little sort of gentle one, or a sort of one that grew organically out of in front of a church that you would see in New York usually, which I always like. I think they're very sweet and very spiritual, and I really sort of soak up the message of whatever is being conveyed there. But this I saw, this creche I saw was in an extremely prominent place, and it was gigantic, completely out of place, and really, and was on what I assume is public property, and it really pissed me off for various reasons. This is not part of the attack on Christmas. Christmas is fine with me. I have celebrated Christmas in many different ways, probably more than any Jew you ever met. But so I'm writing an essay in this case. I wrote an essay about my experiences, my personal experiences with this, and then going back into my childhood about my experiences with Christmas and with Catholics and Jews and the way I grew up in New York. And a little bit about the principle of the separation of church and state. And I got a lot of good reactions to it and a couple of extreme reactions telling me it was anti-Christian. But if you're interested in this kind of stuff, and it's a pretty good essay, though I say it myself, who shouldn't, send me, since it's not on my website, send me an email to, and you can find my email by going to the Feder Files, my website, FederFiles.com, FederFiles.com. And hold on, I'm just going to adjust something here. Oh, that's better. You don't mind a little silence, right? A little silence on the air, a little time for contemplation in between the endless river of music and talk that goes on 24/7 on 250,000 radio stations. Here, I'll do it again. Peaceful, right? It's peaceful. Peace, peace and quiet. I don't know how much of that you need. If you live in a city, you need a lot. A city like New York, especially, you need a lot of peace and quiet if you go out in the city a lot, which I have occasion to do sometimes. Yeah, so if you want a copy of this, I will send it to you. I think I could send it to you. Since my computer keeps, the software and the net keeps changing all the time, I used to be able to attach documents and send them to people, but I'm not really sure I can do that anymore. Maybe I will post it on my website. But if you want it, you want to get a copy of it, I will try to send you one, but you have to go to FederFiles.com and then contact me through my email, and then I can try to send it to you. About 2 weeks ago, in fact, on December 8th, it was the two-year anniversary of maybe the most, well, one of the most disastrous things that ever happened to me in my life. I was walking along on Riverside Drive in Manhattan, talking to my wife, something we did every Sunday morning. It was a Sunday morning. And suddenly, I felt like somebody had scooped out my entire chest, like there was nothing in there at all. My legs turned to rubber. I fell to the ground, and I knew there was something wrong with my heart. And all kinds of stuff was going on. I was passing in and out of consciousness, and so my wife was terrified. She found somebody. We don't carry a cell phone around with us. Now we do. she got somebody to call the ambulance, and then I hear the ambulance in the distance, and I was going in and out of consciousness. I couldn't move. I had fallen on the ground. The ambulance, they loaded me in, passed out. I think I woke up on a table in the emergency room, gurney, is that what it's called? And there was my wife, and there's a doctor, female doctor, somewhat young, I thought, as much as I was, you know, conscious of anything, lying flat on my back. And she said, sir, you've had a serious tear in your aorta, and if we don't operate immediately, you will die. That's putting things very clearly. You know, something like this happens, and I think there was some quote from Emerson that I saw actually in a movie. I'm so illiterate. So there was a quote from Emerson that was in a movie. I think it was Saving Private Ryan, and I'm paraphrasing it. It was like at war, he was in, talking about being in the Civil War. War sharpens the sensibilities. Well, being told that if they don't do something in an emergency in a minute to save you, you will die. What they didn't tell me, and I found out later, was that I probably was going to anyhow. There was roughly a 50-50 chance, although I think I was tipping in the other direction. And, you know, I looked at looked at the woman, looked at the doctor, looked at my wife, and I said, yeah, okay, operate. I don't remember anything after that until I woke up, which was apparently 3 days later, although I wasn't aware of what day it was or whether it was even night or day, in a room in the ICU of St. Luke's Hospital up where I live. And I had been through 8 hours of open heart surgery, 8 hours of open heart surgery, where they, if you want to hear about this, tune away and try some television series that they all do these days, some detective series that features gruesome serial killers or some other relaxing thing to entertain yourself. But if you want to hear this, you could tune away for a little bit, but it's no big deal compared to what goes on in the world and what you see on television or read in books or the newspapers. So what? So they crack you open. They take a saw. They saw down the middle of your body. They crack you open like a lobster. And they, you know, they open up your heart and lung. It's a heart-lung machine they put you on. But they open up your heart, and they attempt to save your life. 8 hours this took. 8 hours. I was told. I didn't know. Mercifully, obviously, I have to say that I was passed out. I was out. Either I was passed out or certainly they were giving me something to keep me passed out. I mean, who could survive that, the shock of that, and be awake, right? And I was on a heart-lung machine, and perfectly understand what that is. In any case, my heart wasn't working for 8 hours. Some artificial heart was pumping blood through my body or around my body. And some artificial machine was breathing for me. I was not doing those things. Very strange. So about 3 days later, after a coma I was in, I wake up, and there I am in tremendous pain, lying flat on my back, can hardly move at all. And my wife and children are staring down at me. My kids, who are grown, had flown in from the different cities they live in, not New York. And they were all standing there staring at me, looking extremely happy to see that I was awake and conscious and alive. And it's to talk about disoriented is putting it very mildly, right? And little by little, over the next couple of days, I learn what happened to me, that they had done this operation. And I asked some questions. It was a tremendous amount of pain that I was in because, after all, look what they did. Sawed me, ripped me, cracked me open, and then sewed me up. They reached inside me and tampered with, like, serious, you know, my heart, right? Basically, it's my aorta. So it's an extraordinary experience. And when they put people on a heart-lung machine, sometimes what happens is that people become, afterwards, they experience a certain kind of psychosis for days or even weeks afterwards. A little bit of it, I think, kind of remains. And with me, it's difficult to tell. I mean, since I am on the verge of that kind of thing and have been off and on, more than on the verge of that all my life. But there's something called a heart-lung machine psychosis. And it just deranges your brain. Hopefully that it's not permanent, but sometimes there are certain permanent lingering effects of it, which I probably have. Also, they give you certain drugs, powerful drugs having to do with your heart, and sedatives and other things. Now, I was taking drugs already for various psychiatric problems and other problems, but they give you very, very strong particular kinds of drugs, and you often, very often, have, from the heart-lung machine and from the drugs, hallucinations. And I was having very, very crazy, in-color, horrible hallucinations. I had had that once or twice before in my life, and it was indescribably frightening. Reality just bends and twists, and you're not in the real world anymore. It's like you're lost in some terrible black Disney world. But these hallucinations, sleeping and waking, when I tried to close my eyes or when I tried to drift off to sleep, I would have these hallucinations, and they were horrible. And because of the hallucinations and because of my past history of, you know, like a history of violence, because of my past history of disturbance in my brain, they assigned a psychiatrist. I guess it's maybe standard procedure. Also, people get very... people do. Well, a lot of people do have these hallucinations. Hold on. There's some of the wires here are tangled. You work in a radio studio. You have to deal with many different kinds of wires. So I'm all hooked up to different wires. A little bit like I was in a hospital. They're not tubes, but they're wires. Anyhow, I just straightened it out. So they assign a psychiatrist to see you, and especially they assign one to see me. Because I was, you know, I had been hallucinating, and who knows what I was saying and yelling when I was hallucinating. Also because people become extremely depressed. This is standard after one of these operations, especially if people are older. They become very, very depressed afterwards. So between the two things, they assign a psychiatrist to me who showed up every day, made regular visits. I don't know where the psychiatric department was in St. Luke's, on a different floor. And he was an Indian man, originally Indian. I mean, he was an American now, but he had still a very pronounced Indian accent. He was a man about in his early, maybe his early 40s, early to mid 40s, maybe early 40s. He seemed very young to me. At my age, everybody that age seems very young. And he was somewhat dark-skinned, and he was clearly, he looked Indian, right? And he was very spiffy. He had a suit on that had, I'm not good at describing physical things, but he had a suit on that was very sharp, and it was, it had different, it had lines on it. It wasn't just a plain, you know, cloth, one-color suit. It had different kinds of lines on it. I'm sure there's some word for it. So he was kind of like kind of a jazzy suit, but not too, you know, expansive, but a little sort of a jazzy suit. And it looked expensive from what all I know about fashion, right? Been wearing a flannel shirt my whole life. His hair was very dark and thick, and he had it not slicked back, but sort of, you know, carefully arranged back on his head. Very shiny, clearly well taken care of, shined, expensive black shoes. And as I say, a sort of a pronounced accent. And he made these visits to me, and he was extremely decent. I've unfortunately known a few psychiatrists in my time, and they always sort of tended to be a little bit aloof, maybe sometimes arrogant, drew a line between you and them. They were the doctor, and you were the patient. They're the sick person. You're the sick person, and they're the well person. And they're the doctor, and they're going to, you know, you're the patient. But this guy was just talking to me. He was a very, and I took it that his demeanor and his aura was because he was originally from India. I don't know when he came over here. Maybe he was in his teens or 20s. He came over here to go to medical school. He, to me, he seemed like not a typical Western psychiatrist. He seemed like an Eastern man, a man of the East. And when we talked to each other, he had to lean in. He was already very personal, more personal than I was used to with a psychiatrist or with a therapist. He would lean in. You know, I'd sit in a chair. Next to this, that's when I could get up finally and sit in a chair. And he would pull up another chair. And we would be no more than a foot or two apart. And he had to lean in to hear what I had to say. And I had to lean in to talk to him. The reason for that was because of the tubes that were down my throat for 8 hours during the surgery, and because during the surgery they nicked a vocal cord, which has caused a permanent hoarseness and difficulty with me talking. That's something I have to accept and live with. And too bad I'm on the radio, right? But they nicked a vocal cord. There's one of your vocal cords. I think it's your left vocal cord. I don't mean you personally, if you're listening to this, but I mean everyone's Well, everyone's left vocal cord loops for some who knows what reason, loops around near your heart or around your heart. And sometimes when they do these operations, when they do any heart operation or surgery in that area, they can occasionally nick or cut a vocal cord. So between the tubes and them nicking this vocal cord, I was talking in a croaking whisper, and my throat was beyond sore. I could hardly talk like this. And so he had to lean in to hear me. And for somebody who is used to being so facile and so articulate with language, for somebody who was so able to speak at length and to make themselves understood in sometimes very subtle and, as I say, sort of like articulate ways about how they felt or what they thought, this was extremely frustrating to me. It would be to anybody, but it was very frustrating to me. So we have these conversations. And because I couldn't speak very much and it made me tired and my throat even more sore to even say a few words, and because I was having trouble even comprehending him, I was just, you know, pulling out of these hallucinations and just getting over this operation. He took to taking, I had a notepad there that my wife had brought to me, and I was writing notes on it sometimes for things and saying, could you, you know, whatever it was I thought that was hard to say, I wrote down, right? I wrote down. So he took my notepad when we had these conversations about my psychiatric condition or about psychiatric conditions in general. And he started using the notepad to illustrate things. And he would make graphs and drawings and with arrows and circles. And, you know, since I was, you know, I don't know, whatever is my imaginings of what it's like to be an Indian and how you grow up in a different culture. And it is a different culture than growing up in the West. And because I had studied Buddhism and I knew a little bit about Hinduism, and there's a lot of mandalas and you know, art that Eastern art, I took to you know, to thinking of him as less of a psychiatrist and more of a kind of a guru or like a Zen master, even though he's wearing this spiffy Western suit and well, he was using sometimes, you know, psychiatric terminology. But to me, I decided that with all these drawings he was doing and the way he came across, that he was a man of the East. And one time he was talking to me, and he used to come every day and stay for a long time, which I truly appreciated. Made a big difference to me in feeling better right after the surgery and ultimately being, you know, discharged after about 3 weeks in the hospital. One time he asked me, he says, well, now that you survived, what do you want most? And I had been, I guess, unconsciously thinking about that. Or is that a contradiction? I had been unconsciously, that had been rolling around in my unconscious, right? And it was welling up in me, connected to other, like, powerful feelings I had. He said, now that you survive, what is the thing you want most? Which was quite a question, right? A serious existential question. And I leaned in, and I knew suddenly exactly what I wanted most. I knew what I wanted most. It's something I always wanted, but I didn't realize it as sharply until that moment after what had happened and when he asked me in that setting. And I leaned in, and I croaked to him. You know, I whispered in this croaking whisper, I want to stop feeling so desperate, I told him. And he shook his head and smiled at me. He says, I want to stop feeling, I said, so desperate. Because I realized that I was seized while I was sitting in the hospital there. I was totally, everything was out of my control. And I'm always hypervigilant in all my life and trying to control everything for very good reasons. And it's never done anything but wear me out and make me feel as if life does not meet my expectations or that I am out of, actually, in attempting to control everything or imagining that I can control everything, I feel more out of control than somebody who wouldn't go to such efforts to control everything. Does that make sense? Can I explain that? In other words, if you're so concerned with everything being exactly the way you want it to be every minute and you're disappointed and irritated if it's not, then you get worn out And you see the world as a place that is, and yourself, as something that's uncontrollable. If you don't even pay attention to that, or if you don't need to, if you don't feel that desperate need to have everything secured and under control, well, then God bless you. You don't worry about it. You don't get exhausted, and everything seems even more in control because you're not worried about controlling it. Anyhow, so much for that. So I said, I want to stop feeling so desperate. And suddenly, of course, what happened to me happened in 1 second. I was walking along. I had a couple of good years there. And up until that second when my aorta decided to blow up, I was doing pretty well. I thought, although right before this, for about a month or two before this happened to me, I did notice that I was feeling more and more of, there was always an underlying feeling in my life of desperation, of something about to get me or something that I had to get. And I was always sort of, you know, desperately trying to grasp onto this thing, although I didn't know quite what it was, or desperately trying to get away from this thing, maybe two separate things, or maybe they're, you know, two sides of the same coin. And I was feeling it more and more and more. Although I was feeling better and doing better in my life, I still felt this old, familiar feeling that always sort of was part of my body and my mind, a feeling of the grasping desperation. And at this moment, of course, when I was speaking to him, I realized that one thing clearly was that here I am older and now having had this and almost died and having some permanent losses from this. I mean, I could hardly walk. They had to sort of teach me how to walk again, how to talk. And it was months before I could get up and walk around the block and do things that I had done easily before that. And some of this stuff has stayed with me, including the nicked vocal cord, which limits my ability to speak at any kind of length, which, yes, I know, that's a good thing. But you're still listening, right, if you're still listening. So, and I realized that one of the desperate things I was talking about was that I had always had this feeling of mortality, like everybody else. So the suppressed terror and fear of death, of annihilation, of the end of things, had suddenly popped up and was looking me right in the face. And some of these hallucinations were about stuff like that. And I guess I realized that I had always sort of drifted along in my life like some kind of Peter Pan child, that even though I was older, I wasn't ever that sick physically. I didn't even have any kind of life-threatening, you know, I had some close calls, but I never had any life-threatening illness. And although I had been sick like anybody else, I never had anything like even approaching what happened to me. So suddenly the whole idea of old age, illness, pain, loss, it just hit me in the face, or it hit me like a car would hit you if you weren't looking the right way when you cross the street. Bang! And I realized I can die. Now, I know that sounds absurd, but how many people actively think about that unless they actually are faced with it or they have to? Maybe if you're in a war situation, or maybe you live in a war zone, or if you work in an emergency room in a hospital, or various other things. But the average person walking around necessarily suppresses that. You can't function if the dread of mortality is constantly with you. But suddenly, after a lifelong covering this up, and I guess I always realized at that moment that I'd lived a fairy tale, like lived in a fairy tale of my own devising, that I thought that maybe I would never get old. 68 even. I was 68 years old when this happened. That's 2 years ago. I thought maybe I will never get old. I've never been that sick. I will just go along the way I'm going along. Nothing will change. Everything will be the same. And it was a delusion, an illusion, a fairy tale. And I realized that I had had this my whole life, that nothing would change and nothing would be different and nothing would be lost. Nobody I knew would suffer. My wife would go along forever. I would go along forever. And suddenly I'm faced with this tremendous dose right in my face of mortality. And it wasn't just that. I realized when I was telling him that I want to stop feeling so desperate, it wasn't just about the fear of death and loss and pain and the fear of death. It was about something that was much older than that in me, something that had been with me since forever, since I was a little kid, and that was always with me and never left me. It was something else that I was desperate about. I wasn't sure what it was. I really wasn't sure what it was, but I knew there was something else. Yeah, life in the fast lane. You could live it consciously. There are people, don't we all know them? Maybe you're one of them who lives in the fast lane or has lived in the fast lane. I know a lot of people listening to me are slowing down now, necessarily slowing down. And some people, even though they're older, aren't slowing down. And good for you if it's something that you feel engaged with or something that's very rewarding. But there's always a kind of, aside from the fact that the fear of mortality as you get older is a stronger fear. And as you see friends perhaps get sick and die, which I have in the last couple of years, close friends. So it starts to affect you. But there was another desperation I was telling them about. About a year ago, in an attempt to try to come to terms with something or try maybe to get in touch with this desperation or try to control it, though I wasn't exactly still sure what it was, although I had a pretty good idea, having been in therapy on and off my whole life, I started meditating again. I had done this. I had been meditating on and off. It's just sitting still. Sometimes guided meditation with a tape or then, of course, a CD. There's no more tapes. And having somebody, just guide you, where you just kind of mindfulness meditation, different kinds of meditation, where you just sit quietly in a kind of a dignified, straight up and down posture. You could sit on the floor with your legs crossed, as you've seen, right? Or maybe you've done that. Or you could sit in a chair, and since if I try to cross my knees on the floor, I would probably never get up again. So I was sitting in a chair, and I started meditating. I had done this, like I say, off and on in my life, and I had often done this myself at home with this guided tape. But now I joined a group. There was a group that I found at a local, very modern, very fancy kind of Jewish cultural center. It's called the JCC on the Upper West Side where I live. There's a synagogue there. There are rabbis there, but it's a Jewish cultural center. It's got, it's a very modern thing. It's got workout places. It's got pools. It's got every kind of program you could possibly imagine, meetings. It's a seven-story powerhouse of a place. And it is very oriented towards Jewish culture, but, they don't exclude anybody. They include anybody who wants to join and get involved. There's a school there for kids. There's programs for people who are disabled. There's no end of things there. But they have, they had, and they still have, a meditation group every morning from 7:30 to 8:30 in the morning. And every evening from 5:45 to 6:45, and except on Fridays, of course, in the evenings. It's a Jewish place after all. And it's a special room that they built. It's a long room. Maybe it's about 30 feet long and maybe about, 15, 16 feet wide. And I'm not too good at dimensions of things. And It's a room, and the lights can be turned down. There's a dimmer that can be turned down. And they use this room to conduct meditation groups and also for yoga classes. So the room has, mats and chairs, yoga mats. It has cushions, blankets. When they designed the place, though, when they made this room, they made one mistake. Was it's right off the hallway near a bank of elevators where there's a lot of other meetings and people going back and forth. And they have glass doors. They didn't think about soundproofing this place, which would be very useful for yoga and especially meditation. But so often there is a lot of sound coming in there. But the lights could be dim. And basically you just sit there in this room. And chairs, when they're arranged, they're 16, 18, 22 chairs, depending on how many people show up for different classes. They're arranged in an oval inside this room, a long oval. And it's very, very powerful. And so we all sat there, and the leader of the group say a few words in the beginning, or talk to people a little bit about what meditation was if they hadn't been there before, and to just stay in touch with your breath, whatever thoughts come into your head and go out, and the whole idea of contemplating what the Buddhists call the monkey mind. Your mind never stops thinking. If you're occupied with something or you're concentrated on something outside you, if you're doing a job, maybe if you're watching TV, if you're concentrating on anything, like if you're in, building a building, fixing plumbing, preparing a lesson plan, teaching kids, performing, being on the radio, if you're concentrating, then your mind tends to be concentrated too. But just sitting often, you know how your mind will just wander. It'll just go all over the place. It jumps around like a monkey, and some people worse than other people. And so there would be long periods of just sitting in stillness, long periods of sitting in stillness and in silence. And what they did was they had a rotating rotating group of leaders. Monday it was a rabbi. Tuesday, some students that are being taught to lead classes. Wednesday, kind of a Zen master type. And Thursday, somebody else. So each night was a different person. So, but on Mondays, the rabbi would run things. And he would sit on the floor with his legs crossed. He was a rabbi, though. He had his yarmulke on. And he was... this guy had a congregation, I think. He's a guy in his late 40s. Had a congregation out in California someplace. Maybe it was Los Angeles. And somehow he became interested in Buddhism. So he's still a licensed practicing rabbi, but he's more of a circuit rabbi. Doesn't have a congregation anymore. And he got very, very immersed in the whole idea and practice of meditation, of mindfulness, of and there's all different kinds of meditation. There's Jewish meditation, there's Christian meditation, there's a million different kinds. But this is essentially all four of these different teachers practice this sitting still, focusing on the breath, in and out, in and out, and just accepting whatever comes, whatever feelings arise, whatever comes into your mind. Well, about 2 weeks ago, I think the second week of Hanukkah, the rabbi on a Monday night brought in a menorah, a small brass menorah, and some candles, and inserted, I think maybe the second night of Hanukkah, inserted some candles in the menorah, and I looked at these candles, and I realized that these candles, I've seen these candles since I was a kid. If you're Jewish, you know these candles. If you're not, you really wouldn't know them. But it's a small box of candles, and they're all colored. They're wax candles, and they are, or tallow, whatever they make candles out of. But they're the same. It looks like the same company, the same box, and the same candles. They're about, 8 inches long and maybe a quarter of an inch wide in circumference, whatever. Not circumference. What's the word for it? A quarter of an inch wide and about 8 inches long. And then there's a wick. And they're all brightly colored. They're all different colors, almost like crayons. They look like crayons. And I saw these candles, and it was the same candles we used when I was a kid. and this is going back like 60 years now, right? Same candles that we used in a menorah that we had in our kitchen. And for reasons I don't understand, because I'm ignorant in a lot of ways about my own religion, you're supposed to put the menorah, when you light the candles, you're supposed to put it in a window so that everybody else can see it, maybe a sign to the world that the candles are still burning, that the Spirit of the Lord is still alive and with you, and you are still alive and with the Lord. So, but the same candles, and these candles are made to burn at a certain length. I forget what it is. It's either 45 minutes, 50 minutes, maybe an hour. When you light them, they're actually of a size, and they're designed to burn for a standard amount of time. So he put the candles in the menorah, and when everybody had come in, he gets a lot of people in his class because he's an extremely good leader and teacher of meditation, and he gives little sermons afterwards. When everybody was seated, he got up and he lit the candles and he chanted these prayers, which I had not heard since my grandmother was alive. And that's 55 years ago. My grandmother died when I was 15. And I had been to other Hanukkah services when I was a kid before I drifted off. After my grandmother died, there was no real religion or religious cohesiveness at all or holidays celebrated in my family. She kept it all together. She was from the old country and felt it was very important. I'm not sure whether she believed in God or not, but she definitely kept the Jewish rituals for many different reasons, having come from a place where Jews were cut down like grass by various people participating in pogroms over in Eastern Europe, Russians and whoever else. So she felt it was essential to keep the family together and to keep this Jewish tradition. And he chanted these prayers, and it brought back all kinds of bittersweet memories of my childhood. Any kind of gathering of my family was always something of a, like home, everybody's got this, right, in some way. You know, all these movies about home for the holidays. It's a national understanding. They make movies and write books about how difficult it is when you're grown up to go back to, when you're older, to go back to your family or be with your family. How much comes out, how much old stuff comes out, how much you avoid it and how much you look forward to it, with all your old yearnings and all your needs and all your unmet needs and all the love you had and all the love you wanted and old arguments and troubles you had with your parents. All of this stuff happens during family holidays. But so I had some bittersweet memories of Hanukkah when I was a kid, most of which had to do with the fact that my mother was so disturbed, and so everything sort of revolved around her disturbances. Well, so he lit the candles, and he said, okay, let's contemplate the flame of these candles. Let's contemplate the flame as we meditate tonight. And bang, he was done. And we sat there for the longest time. And for somebody like me, even sitting for 10 minutes without wanting to get up or feeling like mom was going to start like jumping around or having my thoughts feel like they're going to blow up like some kind of pinwheel in my head, like, a lit pinwheel. It was really something. It was a long, long, long sit. They call it a sit. Maybe it went on 45 minutes. Imagine sitting, unless you're used to this, 45 minutes still without twitching, jumping, talking, and just following your breath, whatever comes to your head. So it was like frenetic for me, but I did it. And afterwards, when he hit the gong, three hits of the gong to bring us out of not a trance that you're in, but another state, or if you haven't managed to rise above your monkey mind, and you're still thinking about things that happened yesterday, or you're worried about something, or things are preying on your mind, but still you try to just let them in and out of your mind, and you follow your breath. It's like an anchor, just right? So afterwards, after he hit the gong, he talked for a little while, and he said, you look at the flame, and you see that the flame, and you look at the flame, and you look at the candle, and you see that the flame is never the same from one moment to the next. The flame is always flickering in one direction or another, up, down, sideways. It's flickering. It looks different. It's a different color. The flame is changing all the time. And the candle is changing all the time. And he said, and so are we changing all the time. You're not the same person right now when I'm talking to you as you were this morning. Indeed, you're not the same person right now as you were a minute ago when you were listening to something else I was saying. And he was saying, this is about, and the world is changing around you all the time. And everybody you know is changing. And, you know, if you think about this long enough, it starts to make you dizzy, right? But the point is not to have that happen, but the point is to actually do the opposite. The point of discussing the fact that change is constant all the time about everything. To be able to contemplate that in a centered way gives you a sense of not permanence yourself, but it gives you a sense of feeling anchored to something. And he said, so we're not the same from moment to moment. And even the image we have of ourselves, think of yourself. You know who you are. You're Bob, you're Ed, you're Sheldon, you're Rosemary, you're Jane, whoever you are, right? You're Ellen. And you know exactly who you are. You know exactly who you are. You're that person, and you've always, you know, you grew up a certain way, and you know who you are. But he was saying, this rabbi, in his very sort of spiritual kind of sweet way that he had, he said, even our image of ourselves is not necessarily a true image. What we believe we are is not necessarily the way it is, because we're changing all the time. What we assume we are, what we wish we were, what we demand we should be, you know, what we superego, what we hold up to ourselves that we should do and who we should be all the time, the way we were brought up, whatever complex psychological input went on, or whatever your nature is. And he was talking about change and impermanence, the whole idea of impermanence, how everything is changing all the time. And that's what the lesson was, watching these candles and the flame and burn down and changing all the time. And to get used to accept the idea is to accept the idea of change, of losses, sometimes terrible losses, of things that change that are positive in your life, but things are always changing. And to attempt to deny this change and this impermanence of life and your body and your mind and your spirit is to fight against the eternal truth of things, which is that everything is impermanent and changing all the time. So it can bring you, although, you know, it could take many years or decades for people who practice this, it can to get some peace, a certain sense of calmness and a kind of an anchor in the midst of change, that since you are aware of it and you know it, that in itself, ironically, gives you a sense of permanence. I know it sounds completely ironic, but to be aware that everything is impermanent can give you a sense of security and calmness. Now, since it was the 2-year anniversary of all this stuff happening to me, and so many things have lingered with me, and I have gone through so many losses in my professional life and in my body and in my mind is still very turbulent and depressed from what happened a couple of years ago in one split second. There was a change, right? Talk about a change in my life. And many changes have happened since then. Most of them have not been too pleasant. But as I was thinking about this the other day, and when I came home from listening to the rabbi, and what he said really affected me. And then it dawned on me, not that I hadn't some real clues for a long time, but that the other constant source of desperation, which I had been telling or attempting to tell the Indian psychiatrist about, this grasping, desperate feeling I had since childhood, which I still have, and which has always accompanied me everywhere I have gone, in my head, in my body, in my behavior, in my relationships, it all came from the way I grew up. And briefly, since I've mentioned this 1,000 times, you know, I grew up in a very disturbed, crazy household. And I lived in an attic room, which was very dark, in a house that my father had set up. He made this room out of an attic, unfinished attic. This is where my bedroom was. And then he took off. And it was always very dark there because it was not on the side. It was on the north side of the house, not on the south side where the sun came in. So it was dark, and it overlooked a cemetery. And and my parents, my father was gone when I was 4 years old. Gone, gone, gone. Foreign country, gone. Always traveling. I could never get a hold of him, never knew where he was. Always sort of felt like I was chasing after him, even if I wasn't physically chasing after him. My mother downstairs, the poor woman, very, very seriously mentally ill and disturbed, dangerous, raving, ranting, sometimes lashing out physically. And I realized that the desperation I was feeling was left over from that time when I was sitting in that room yearning for somebody to relieve the loneliness and the feeling of fear I had as a child, the total insecurity, looking for some parent, my parents, to somewhat magically materialize into some different kind of parents, like, again, like in a fairy tale, that I realized that I had spent my entire life up until this moment when I'm talking to you. Sometimes it's at a low level, and sometimes it's like somebody turned the flame way up, and this feeling of desperation almost takes over my whole life, a kind of manic yearning and a certain rage and despair. And I realized that my whole life I had been grasping and demanding that I get those things that, of course, I didn't get and I can never get, and I have not accepted it. And so I stay in that room, that dark room, and like frozen in place, rigid. And while my entire life, all my other relationships up until including now, everything I do, everything is passing me by. And here I am now old, getting older and old, whatever the definition is in the modern world of old, but I guess I'm old, still with that filter of despair and bitterness and rage and a desperate demand in me that everything be the way it never was, that things wrap themselves up. So I thought about all these things, and I wrote it. And I, all week long after seeing the rabbi, I wrote this stuff down, and I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I was writing from the bottom of my heart, from my gut, from my unconscious. And it was good writing. And then I wrote all day, the Sunday before this Sunday, I wrote all day long, several hours. So I wrote like 30 hours of stuff in this article, and it was good, deep writing. And it came, like I say, from my guts. There was like 8, 9, 10 pages of it. And I was approaching the end of the first draft of this, and I accidentally hit some keys. I don't know what I hit, and the document disappeared. It was gone. I did everything I could to get it back that I knew, and I couldn't get it back. Finally, I called Microsoft, and they switched me to India. So now I'm back in the East. They switched me to India, and by remote control, they took over my computer. They advised me, and nobody could retrieve this document. I had done some rare, crazy, stupid thing with the keys and deleted this document, and it wasn't a document. It was the contents of it, and it was gone. So after all of this, writing about everything I'm talking to you about right now, in a second, just like the second where I lost my ability to have a heartbeat, in a second, everything I wrote had disappeared. And my wife, and I'm freaking out. I'm going crazy. I'm jumping around. I'm yelling and screaming. And my wife says, calm down, calm down. Don't you see that this is about, what were you writing about? What were you writing about? I said, impermanence. And she said, well, there's your illustration. What better illustration could you want? Things change. And I said, like this? She said, this is a change. Now you have a new story to tell. And when I went back the next time to see the rabbi, I told him about what happened. And I told him, I said, this is an illustration, I guess, of impermanence. And he smiled at me, a sweet sort of benevolent smile. And he said, yes, it certainly is.